This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Well, this week, the Department of Veterans Affairs rolls out a major overhaul of how the nation's veterans receive private health care through the VA. Now, the practice of sending veterans to private providers, known as Veterans Choice Program, began under the Obama administration as a way to address long wait times at VA facilities and better serve veterans in rural areas. But VA Secretary Robert Wilkie says it was rushed into existence and has created administrative challenges for the second largest department in the federal government. Secretary Robert Wilkie spoke with HPR's Ryan Finnerty ahead of a planned visit to Hawaii about the new program called the VA Mission Act.
Choice said it was essentially a ticket to go out onto the free market for any number of veterans without any coordination, without any planning. What Mission Act does is it takes choice and it changes it so that if we cannot provide a service to a veteran in a timely manner, if we do not have a service that a veteran needs, then that veteran sits down with VA, and we will have on June 6th something called the decision support tool for our medical professionals to use. That veteran will sit down, go through the options available to him or her in terms of services outside of the department. That's particularly important for veterans who have to travel long distances, that they have to travel past other medical facilities to get to a VA. It is not libertarian VA in the sense that Choice tried to push us in that direction by essentially giving people a card and saying, go forth and prosper in the private sector. You have to meet certain criteria. You have to be a certain number of minutes away from a VA facility. We cannot provide you with an appointment for your needs in a certain amount of time, and then you will be able to go out into the private sector and get that care. The only way that works, as I mentioned earlier, is if we are paying our bills. We've let out the contracts for the regions across the country to kick in this year so that we can begin paying bills on time, and that allows our veterans the opportunity to have choice.
And Mr. Secretary, what is the goal for these changes? Because I should say, in the interest of full disclosure, I've used the Choice program as a veteran, and it worked pretty well. I was able to go and get, in my case, it was physical therapy from a private provider here in Honolulu when it wasn't available at the VA. Right. And it was pretty quick. It was affordable. And I didn't have to wait very long. And I didn't really encounter any of the kind of bureaucratic red tape that you often hear about. Yeah. So what are we trying to improve upon?
We're trying to standardize the process across the country. The problem with Choice was that they had different standards in the Southwest, different standards in the Midwest, different standards out in the Pacific. Things were not uniform. In the East Coast, we have the phenomenon of having veterans, particularly from the North, say Maryland North, who head to Florida and Texas in droves in the winter. They use VA in Florida and Texas in the winter, and then they go back home to the Northeast in the summer. Two different standards of access and availability that was confusing people. We were making redundant payments because the systems did not match up. This has one system for everyone, and that is a massive step forward from where Choice was. You should continue to have the same access outside of VA that you had, but we needed to create a single system that everybody understood. They knew the rules of the road, and it was a system that would have been familiar to most veterans, having had that same system while they were in service.
And how will the new system be rolled out? Because I've spoken confidentially with a few providers, and they've expressed some concerns that there could be a lapse in care as the new program is rolled out.
I've heard that. I don't think there will be. We've started the education process already. Our people are now working with the decision support tool to make sure that's online on June 6th. You always have concerns when there is a change. I delivered a report to the White House today saying that I'm confident that we'll be able to move out on June 6th with the first phase of the Mission Act. We have redundancies in place if there is a hiccup. Any military organization would have that. But I'm confident that we'll be able to build on what worked with choice, but make that available to the entire nation.
And you mentioned a little bit earlier, but what can, from the veteran perspective, what can veterans expect to see differently?
They're not going to see that much change unless there is something that they need that we don't have. You mentioned in your case it was physical therapy. What I expect to have happen is that they will go to their healthcare provider at VA. A screen will pop up in that healthcare provider's office, and we will go through a list of options that the veteran has in the private sector. Now, let's take a look at what's been happening in VA just in the last year. We've seen veterans vote with their feet. Less than 1% of those veterans who were eligible for full choice used full choice. The Annals of Internal Medicine, produced by Dartmouth Medical School in December, said that VA healthcare is good or better than any place in the country. And then the Journal of the American Medical Association in January said our wait times in the major categories like primary care, cardiology, oncology, are as good or better than any in the private sector. So we've actually seen a dip in the number of veterans requesting service in the private sector to the point where it's as low as it has ever been, which is a testament to the improvements in VA.
And I know there have been concerns from some members of Congress and observers about calls for increased privatization in the VA.
Right.
When I read the provisions of the Mission Act, it seems like it's going in the opposite direction from privatization.
Well, I agree with you, and let me validate your observation. I just presented a $220 billion budget to the United States Congress. I've had 8 hearings this year. The budget calls for a VA force of 390,000 people. That's a 20,000 person increase from what we are authorized now. If we are privatizing, we are going about it in a very strange way. So my goal is what the Mission Act was very clear. It said that the health of the veteran is the central factor in all decisions made by VA, not the prerogatives of the institution, but the health of the veteran. And if that means that we send the veteran into the private sector, we do. But your experience, my experience, is that most of those who have served want to go someplace where people speak the language and understand the culture. And I have seen that in my military career. I think you've experienced it in Hawaii and in your military career. So I think the other reforms that we're doing, the reforms on the supply chain, reforms on HR, the electronic health record, set up VA to be a modern 21st century healthcare administration that will only enhance the feelings of veterans toward VA and bring them into the system at a greater rate than we see now. One thing you and I have discussed in the past, I have paid particular attention to rural veterans, to veterans on the islands, the native communities of America, for a couple of reasons. One, we still don't appreciate the scale of the West and the Pacific in Washington, D.C. It's amazing when you hear people talk that somehow things are the same out in the islands as they would be here in metropolitan Washington, D.C. And the other area that I wanted to concentrate on was the native populations, the native nations, tribes of the United States and the territories, because they participate in the armed forces in rates much higher than any other community in this country. They have the highest number of awards of the Medal of Honor per capita than any other community. And it's important to me. I'm coming back to Hawaii in July. Then I'm headed to Guam, Saipan, the Marianas, to show the flag and to take a close look at what's going on in the Pacific.
Secretary Robert Wilkie, thanks for your time today.
Thank you, and thank you for everything you do.
Robert Wilkie is the U.S. Secretary of Veterans Affairs. He'll be returning to Hawaii in July, as he mentioned, to visit the VA facilities here and across the Pacific. The VA Mission Act takes effect on Thursday, June 6th. We'll have a fact sheet posted with this story at hawaiipublicradio.org. This is The Conversation on statewide, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. For today's quiz, we're thinking of that ever-popular drink, coffee. Now, coffee has a long history in the Hawaiian Islands, dating back to the early 19th century. More than a morning staple, coffee is an important cash crop on the Big Island of Hawaii. The Kona Coast's ideal climate and elevation produces renowned Kona coffee, known around the world for its flavor and richness. Today, most coffee farms grow a Guatemalan variety called Kona Tipica. German expatriate Hermann Wiedemann introduced this variety in 1892, which became popular for its hardiness and high yields. But Wiedemann's cultivar was the second coffee crop grown in the islands, with the first variety introduced almost 70 years earlier. For today's quiz, who first brought coffee to the islands? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets a reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right. In his State of the City address, Mayor Kirk Caldwell underscored his administration's priority to deal with what some call our climate crisis. He rolled out a 160-page strategy, a blueprint for the issues that we need to tackle as the king tides nibble away at our shores and meteorologists brace for the summer storms headed our way. Josh Danbro heads the city's climate change office, and he sat down with us this morning to lay out that plan.
We're really excited about sort of putting together a common and shared vision for the island. We went out and talked to every single neighborhood board. We had over 3,000 folks give their actual input on it and presented to hundreds of other groups and got their feedback as well. And we really tried to reach beyond city government to the private sector. We had a steering committee of over 20 folks that were outside of city government to really say, what does it look like to have a thriving sort of resilient future for the island, and what are the steps that we need to take, whether popular or not, to get there? Sometimes you have to take your medicine and get better for it. And so we've got these 44 actions that are spread across four different areas that really were sort of a group consensus around whether, you know, these are easy low-hanging fruit or whether these are tougher sort of, high aims. These are the kind of things that we need to do over the next few years in order to set us up for success and be able to live and thrive on this island for decades to come.
Okay, and then this is before the city council The administration would like them to adopt it, just to say, hey, we're all on the same page. This is our island.
Yeah, so mayor, you know, in the state of the city, you know, obviously this took a year and a half of work. We'd love to see it become really a vision for the city overall and for the island of Oahu overall, and not just something that we're working on in a silo. And so it would be great if city council would adopt it by resolution and move forward this vision that has been articulated from outside the city as well as inside the city.
Now, the mayor talked about a couple of things. One was a possible moratorium on seawalls. And, you know, we've heard the folks over at DLNR, you know, Sam Lemo has been, mm-hmm. I think, raising that flag for, I don't know, see, more than a decade, I think, just about you harden the seashore and you create more problems.
Yeah, so every time you build a seawall, you're killing a beach. And that's just the way it goes. I mean, as soon as you harden that shoreline, you're stopping the ocean from accessing the sand behind it. That, you know, the beach is now on the move. It wasn't on the move for decades. Now it is on the move, and it needs to be able to breathe and move inland and grab more sand. And so, you know, actually the seawall moratorium wasn't in the resilience strategy. It's not part of this document. But there is a recommendation. One of the 44 is we definitely have to change the way we do our setbacks on this island. We're building too close to the shore. And it's in an area that is getting increasingly hazardous for public safety and for private property. The ocean's getting higher. The surge is going further inland. The storms are getting bigger. They're coming more frequently. So there's just places that we probably shouldn't be building. And so, you know, the resilience strategy called for, we need to take a different look and make sure that we've got a modern setback policy that's more flexible and moves further back. And what Mayor, you know, took the example of the monster homes and said, you know, we saw what monster homes were doing in neighborhoods. There was an initial moratorium that was put just to stop the permitting of these, regularly in neighborhoods until we can get a better policy on the books. And that was his, vision is, you know, maybe we should follow the path of the monster home piece, put a moratorium, not put up any new seawalls that are going to kill our beaches until we have a better policy in place. And that'll take some time. So he's asking the Climate Change Commission to give a recommendation within 6 months around what should that setback ordinance look like and what should guide our future on the coastline.
And then, yeah, the setback issue, you were saying that, in some areas, it may be, 40 feet? In some areas, it may be more than that.
Yeah, well, you need something flexible. I mean, the ocean's now moving, but, you know, our shorelines are different all around the island. You can imagine if you're up on a rocky outcrop, 80 feet above the ocean, 40 feet might be enough, right? The ocean's going to, sea levels are going to rise, but the storm surge is never going to reach you up there. It's steady. It's not falling into the ocean. You know, that might be enough. But in places where you're in a low-lying area, there's beach erosion, you know, the cliffs are falling in. Those are places where you have to take a look forward rather than a look backward. You know, we've existed for decades with a 40-foot setback because the ocean wasn't on the move. Now that it's on the move, we need to see in what parts of the island is it moving fastest and make sure that our setbacks are the furthest in those areas.
Okay, and then, you know, we've just started hurricane season. The prediction, you know, for the summer is we're going to see more erosion because of the king tides, that will start this month.
Yes. Yeah. Well, I mean, so, you know, the issue is that we used to talk about, you know, the climate crisis as something that was generations down the road. We got to do something for our grandkids. Well, the reality is everybody knows it's happening right now. We see the king tides. We see the inundation in the parking lots in Waikiki underneath the buildings. And then the storms. I mean, we just have dodged so many bullets. We've gotten so lucky, but we're not going to be able to do that for forever with these bigger, stronger, more frequent hurricanes coming through our area of the Pacific because of the climate crisis. And so Mayor made a concerted effort to schedule the state of the city, you know, right before hurricane season started, because there's a definite link between climate change and these storm seasons and our preparedness. And resilience is all about being able to survive, adapt, and thrive on this island, regardless of what shocks or stresses come our way. And a hurricane is a definite shock, and we're, you know, knocking on wood that we'll get through another season without getting brushed. We invite folks to go to resilientoahu.org, where they can take a look at the report. It's real easy access on there to page through the 44 actions that have been recommended themselves. There's no priority to them in terms of, you know, this is the first one we got to do. This is the second one. These were sourced from the community, and they really came up as equal, tactics to move us forward in a bunch of different areas. There's four areas that we are focused on. One is long-term affordability. So, you know, when we think about our island, what are the threats to us as a long-term, you know, viable population? We've had population decline 2 years in a row. And so a lot of that is around the cost of living. But then when you look at Puerto Rico after Hurricane Maria, they had 12% drop in population right after Hurricane Maria hit. So we see, you know, the climate crisis and long-term affordability as being the twin threats to us being able to you know, live and thrive on this island along with our keiki. So we've got long-term affordability, being prepared for natural disaster, addressing the climate crisis and being more climate resilient, and then making sure that our communities are tight-knit and a lot of social cohesion. That's our number one tool as an island community to be able to stand back up after something happens. And so in those four areas, there's a ton of different things that we can do. There's some that you may will know about. One of the top recommendations was making sure vacation rentals are addressed. It's taking up the housing stock for our local folks, and it's actually creating some resilience issues because if we do get hit by a natural disaster, suddenly we have all these folks in our neighborhoods that don't have resources, they don't have connections. We're going to end up taking care of them. It's going to be a burden for us. There's things like electric vehicle infrastructure for charging. We've got to get more infrastructure out there so that we can get into hybrids and EVs. We've historically been doing pretty well on reducing our carbon pollution on the electrical grid. We've been making progress, slow but steady progress there, but our transportation emissions are going up. And so we got to make sure that everyone who wants to can afford to get into an electric vehicle or a hybrid, and that we have the infrastructure to allow them to do that.
I know we have an electric car, but there's always a concern like, okay, you go to the North Shore, are you going to find a place to charge up to get back home?
Yeah, and that's the thing. I mean, it's a better technology. As you know, you drive one. It's a great driving experience. Tons of torque, super fast, quiet. It's wonderful. It's actually costs less. Once you have the car, the operations and maintenance is, you know, 50 to 75% the cost. So it's cheaper to be in one. And that's what we're talking about is the solutions to the climate crisis can also be solutions to long-term affordability. We can actually live on this island for less money out of pocket if we do some of these things, just tear the Band-Aid off, change over to 100% renewable energy economy, and do some of these things that are long-term in the benefit of customers and residents here on island. But we got to make the switch. And in order to do that, we got to put some upfront investment to build the infrastructure to allow people to feel comfortable about going all the way North Shore. Now the new cars, so you probably have one old like me, right? 2011. And yeah, you know, it takes a charge to get back into town sometimes. But now the newer ones, they've got, you can go all the way around the island twice and you're good to go.
Okay. But not everybody's that fortunate, right? Okay. And so on Wednesday, the city council takes up a bill to set up a fund to deal with, you know, climate change and resiliency.
Yeah. So we, you know, welcome the support from council and the attention on the issue. I mean, our office is we still consider it pretty new. I mean, I've got kids. A two-year-old is still, you're taking, you know, you're still definitely learning, right? And that's our office. I mean, we're 2 years old. The voters created us in 2016 at the election there. And so we've really been spending all of our time trying to get the capacity built at the office to really address some of these issues, put out the resilience strategy, sort of focus on the policy changes that need to happen. This is another piece of that. The council has put forward a bill to create a fund that would be, you know, help drive some of the changes that the Office of Climate Change, Sustainability, and Resiliency are identifying as needs to make us more safe and secure on the island going forward. And we welcome the opportunity to have it.
Okay. And there are also still a couple of pieces in the works strengthening our building codes, the energy code, the electrical code.
Yeah.
Some of that's in the works.
Yeah, so it's interesting because, you know, some folks don't make the connection normally. You know, I say we work on climate change and sustainability and that codes, building codes is our number one priority. And well, why is that? And people usually think recycling or, you know, not using plastic water bottles or whatever. Those things are important, but codes are really the fundamental rules by which we build our infrastructure on island. And if we're going to build for the future, we need to change the rules by which we build. So, you know, the electricity code already went over from the administration to update the electric code so that we can do photovoltaic panels and energy storage, battery storage, in a more streamlined manner, because that's an increasingly an option for a lot of local homeowners that want to reduce their energy bill. The next one that's been sent over has yet to be scheduled. We're hoping that council moves quickly on this, is the energy code update. And that really focuses in on a few things, making our buildings more efficient so that it costs 30 to 50% less for utilities to live in those homes for our local residents. But we've also got some other things in there that will help even more. Making sure that we're heating our water with renewable energy, whether it's solar or otherwise, and making sure that our new buildings and parking lots have that electric vehicle readiness. Not necessarily a charger, but at least the wire is there to enough of the stalls to make a difference, so that when electric vehicles become cheaper than gas cars, which is projected to be around 2023, that we're building homes and parking lots and structures now that are going to allow us to have the most affordable option for transportation. And we're not locked into an old dinosaur technology.
Right, and you can charge your car right there at home.
Yeah, the time we want to charge cars is at high noon, because that's when all the solar power is out. We've got all these panels deployed more and more across the island. When we have a ton of energy available between 10 and 2 p.m., that's the time we want to be charging cars, and take up that extra capacity. It's going to be dirt cheap energy. So we're going to be able to fill our cars for next to nothing. Really the places where that happens is at work, because you're parked at work, or retail, because you're out shopping and being busy. So you want that ability to charge cars in those parking lots, in those commercial and retail spaces where people are between 10 and 2.
Okay. All right. So it's giving people something to think about as we go through the day, and how we can help protect ourselves and become more resilient all around.
Yeah, this is all about a bright future. I mean, we really, there's certain things we have to do. We always say the irony is, if you want to keep the things you love about Hawaii, that, the reason we're all here is because of the wonderful things about Hawaii, the beaches, the aloha spirit, all the stuff that keeps us connected.
Clean air, clean water.
All of those things are at risk. And all of those things are going to take change in order to keep them the way they are. It takes new policies. It takes new projects. So we're advocating along with, hundreds and thousands of other people that put this together. Let's do the change now so that we can be here forever and thriving on the best place on earth to live.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
Hey, pleasure coming in. Thank you.
That was Josh Jambro, Executive Director of the city's Climate Change, Sustainability, and Resiliency Office.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Coming up on the next On Point, Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist and political philosopher George Will is out with a new meditation on his view of what conservatism really means. His new book is The Conservative Sensibility. He'll join us to talk about it. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
This afternoon at 2, following the world.
In the headlines today, tending to the task everyone loves to hate, and that's renewing your driver's license. For our reality check, Honolulu Civil Beat's Chad Blair on the line today with a first-hand account at the DMV. Good morning, Chad.
Good morning, Catherine. How are you?
Good. I just checked my license, and I still have some time.
Well, that's a good thing to do. What I found out was the city notified me. Plenty of time. You have to do this every 8 years. What did I do? I waited into the last 2 weeks right before it's ready to expire, started reading the instructions from the City Department of Customer Service, and holy smoke, I had to go and get all this paperwork that I never had to before in order to get my license. And I'm hoping that my lesson is a cautionary warning to other folks, because everybody's got to go to the DMV at least a few times in their life.
Yeah, and sometimes it's not fun.
No, and what this all started with was really the September 11th attacks back in 2001. Remember, there was that 911 commission report on what the country could do better, and one of the recommendations was you ought to have stricter enforcement of driver's license. You need to show exactly where your legal presence is. Make sure you have your original Social Security number, birth certificate. How many people have a copy of their original birth certificate? There are other documents as well. And I learned that I did not have those. Here's another thing that caught me by surprise. You can't use a P.O. box anymore. Even though I used a P.O. box for all my mail, all my bills for years, decades, that was no longer acceptable. They needed to have a street residence.
Yeah, that's right. We just did a call-in show, and that was one issue that many people, particularly on the Big Island, a lot of the rural areas, they just use P.O. boxes, and so that was a problem.
Right. There are two other things I'd mention. If you don't have this gold star emblem on your license by October of next year, it's a little gold star in the upper right-hand corner that you get when you renew or get a license. They're not going to let you on airplanes domestically unless you can show some other identification like a passport. This is something that was new as well. There is no gold star currently on my license. I do now have one on my temporary license and will on my permanent once it's mailed. But that caught me by surprise as well. One other thing I should add, you got to do this online. You can't just walk in like the old days. I mean, you can, but you'll probably end up waiting for hours. But if you use the online check-in system, you can be in and out, and I was, in well under a half an hour. I mean, can you imagine that, spending less than 30 minutes at the DMV?
Right, and I know the city just issued a press release about getting those appointments online.
That's right. You can now start doing that 6 months in advance before your license is set to expire. And the city is finding that most people are doing that, but still about 25-28% are still going, showing up in person and finding that it can take a lot of time. So if you don't have a computer or you don't know how to use one or have access, get someone to help you. It really saved me a lot of time.
Right, and you got lucky because you kept checking, right?
I did. Most of the appointments are booked months, and I'm not joking, months in advance, everywhere on Oahu. I don't know if that's the case on the neighbor islands. And just by chance, I happened to check back, and there was one puka open at 3:30 at the Pearl City site, and I got there, and it worked out. So if you don't get online now and find out, you could be renewing months after your license expires, and that's a whole nother mess.
Right, and one thing people should know is that if you have to get a marriage license, a certified copy, right now I think the health department says they've got a month wait. So just to get the documents that you need is kind of a process too.
Yeah, so my strong recommendation is don't wait. Go online. If you read my article that's up today on this, there's links directly to the city's customer services. And I can tell you this, the clerks both at the Hawaii Kai and Pearl City place I visited, very helpful. Such a different experience most of us have back in the day at the DMV.
Yes, they're working on it. All right. Thanks so much, Chad.
Thanks, Catherine.
That was Honolulu Civil Beats politics and opinion editor Chad Blair with today's Reality Check. Again, to read his full story, visit civilbeat.org. And just a reminder, we will be rebroadcasting our call-in show about the Gold Star driver's license next week, Tuesday. Pressure is mounting to find a solution to deal with an out-of-control short-term rental problem here on Oahu. On Friday, the City Council is holding a special meeting to deal with the two bills before it. Ron Minor heads up the Planning and Zoning and Housing Committee. He talked with us this morning about what's on the table.
I am concerned that the proliferation of illegal vacation rentals has become a significant problem. It's had a detrimental impact on the character of our neighborhoods. It's contributed to the shortage of affordable rentals. So clearly, the council needs to take proactive measures or steps to address the issue. I think the solutions are long overdue. Since 1989, when the council passed its ordinance to allow a limited number of short-term rentals, the proliferation of illegal rentals has really mushroomed. It's reached, I think, crisis proportions. So I think action is long overdue, so I'm hopeful that the Zoning Committee on Friday will move out both bills, 89 and 85, for further consideration and final vote by the council in the near future.
Are you hearing that there'll be additional drafts?
Yes. Well, I worked on the proposed drafts to both Bill 89 and 85. The proposed amendments that I have come up with would strengthen the enforcement and regulatory provisions in Bill 89 and the enforcement provisions in Bill 85. So those amendments will be taken up by the Zoning Committee, and I'm hopeful to obtain my colleague's support for those amendments going forward.
Where do you sit as far as the caps?
I support the caps. The only way we're going to bring the problem of the proliferation of illegal rentals under control is to impose a cap. And the cap that's contained in Bill 89 is a cap that I formulated that would allow for 0.5% or 0.5% of dwelling units in the various development districts throughout the islands to be opened up for bed and breakfast units or homes that obtain the necessary registration from the Department of Planning and Permitting.
And do you feel added pressure? I know the governor across the street has a bill that he's looking at to collect the taxes, but there, you know, is concern that basically they'd be legalizing illegal activity.
Yes, and so my desire is for the council to pass out Bill 89 and or Bill 85 and to send it to the mayor for his review and signature before the governor makes a final decision as to whether or not to veto that particular Senate bill. You know, my concern is that if the governor signs a Senate bill into law before the council takes action on the bills that are before us, that it might have the unintended effect of preempting the council from being able to move forward with the regulation and enforcement of our short-term rental laws. So I think that, you know, the county, the city, or the council has an obligation to move forward bills before the governor makes his final decision. And I'm hoping that once the mayor signs whatever bills we pass to him into law, that the governor will take that into account before making a decision, a final decision, as to whether or not to sign the Senate bill into law.
So you've got the clock ticking.
That's correct. My understanding is that the governor has a deadline of June 24 to decide whether or not to veto that particular Senate bill. So it's my hope for the council to be able to move out a bill to regulate short-term rentals and to beef up enforcement with respect to vacation rentals, to pass out a bill to the mayor well before the June 24 deadline.
Okay, yeah, he's got to have a list of those potential vetoes by then, I think. And I know during the last council meeting, you had expressed, I think, some surprise to learn about a settlement of a lawsuit that had to do with, I think, 30-day rentals.
Yes. You know, I wasn't aware of the fact that there was a settlement agreement that had been entered into by the Department of Planning and Permitting and the representatives of short-term rental operators. In regards to these 30-day rental agreements, you know, under the settlement agreement, these 30-day rental agreements are permissible, provided that they are bona fide rental agreements where, for example, the short-term rental operator enters into a rental agreement with a renter or a vacationer, and the rental agreement is bona fide. The you know, the renter pays the fair market rent for a monthly agreement, and if the parties enter into that sort of an agreement, then the renter would have the right to exclusive occupancy of that rental unit for a 30-day period. My concern is that that sort of an arrangement could create a potential loophole. And in fact, it's been brought to my attention that there are certain operators of short-term rentals who have been abusing the law and taking advantage of these 30-day rental agreements by executing or entering into these 30-day rental agreements with a renter or vacationer, and then after signing that 30-day rental agreement, entering into a side agreement that actually limits the occupancy of that unit by the renter to less than 30 days. And that there is all, and then they also have a side understanding that if the renter wants to occupy the premises for up to 30 days, and he or she needs to pay additional consideration. So in that sort of situation, what's happening apparently is that some of these renters and short-term operators are skirting the law and making it appear that they're entering into a 30-day rental agreement when in fact they're they've entered into a short-term rental arrangement instead. So we want to plug up that potential loophole to ensure that we don't have situations where people, you know, these operators of these short-term rentals produce a written rental agreement that appears to be a 30-day rental agreement in order to escape the regulation that would apply to short-term rentals. So I have proposed wording or provisions in Bill 89 that would plug up this potential loophole.
I guess I'm a little surprised that the city would agree to that settlement.
Well, I can see where there might be instances where there could be these legitimate 30-day rental agreements. For example, a situation that has been mentioned during our committee hearings is President Obama when he's come to Oahu to vacation in Kailua. He basically enters into this 30-day or long-term rental agreement where he's allowed to rent out a home for the purpose of vacationing for a period of 30 days or more. And even if he doesn't actually occupy the premises for the full 30 days, it is a bona fide 30-day rental agreement, and he pays the full market value for that. But then there are instances where you may have some shady operators who come forward and they just have these 30-day rental agreements that they present to DPP, when in fact they have a side agreement with the renter, with the understanding that renter is going to be actually staying there for less than 30 days and compensating the operator for a less than 30-day arrangement. And in that situation, you don't have a bona fide 30-day rental agreement. It in fact is a short-term rental. And that short-term rental should be regulated like any other short-term rentals under the law. So it is a potential loophole. It was brought to my attention. I wasn't aware of it until the settlement agreement was brought to my attention at the last council meeting. So I've got provisions in my proposed draft to Bill 89 that would plug up that loophole.
Okay. All right. Well, hopefully there can be a meeting of the minds with the other members on all these really complicated issues.
Yes, I'm optimistic because I think that there is a recognition on the council that action to address the problem of the proliferation of illegal vacation rentals is long overdue, and that the council needs to take proactive and decisive action in the near future.
That was Councilmember Ron Menor, chair of the new combined committee of zoning, planning, and housing. That special meeting is set for Friday at 10 a.m. This is The Conversation on listener-supported Hawaii Public Radio. We now check in with astronomer Christopher Phillips and HPR's Dave Lawrence with this week's Stargazer.
Stargazer time, our weekly look into the massive universe around our tiny planet. Also, a rundown of things we might be able to spot in our dark skies. Turning to the expertise of astronomer Christopher Phillips. Hey, Christopher, welcome back. What do you have for us this week?
Hey, Dave, it's good to be here. So this week's stargazers look out for Jupiter rising in the east shortly after 9 p.m. The moon this week is a waxing crescent, gradually growing brighter towards week's end.
Now, Christopher has something mysterious this week for us, a threat to our dark skies. Is that what it is?
Indeed. Clear, dark skies are precious for stargazers of all kinds. On Hawaii Island, extra steps are taken to ensure the quality of night skies by reducing light pollution from streetlights. But for many stargazers, a new threat has emerged. This threat comes in the form of expanding satellite traffic, starting with the SpaceX Starlink project. Currently, an array of 60 satellites launched into orbit by SpaceX and designed to give planet-wide access to the Internet by providing global satellite coverage. These satellites will allow access to the World Wide Web for many remote communities around the globe.
That sounds like a pretty noble goal, but how is it a threat to the darkness?
Well, satellites can be easily seen with the naked eye on a dark night. They can be very bright and can interfere with images taken from ground-based observatories, and they can spoil the view for amateur astronomers and regular stargazers.
And they can make people think it's a little UFO going by, huh?
Exactly.
But it seems like there's so much junk up there already, and 60 of them doesn't seem like a whole lot. Is this really a threat to the darkness?
Well, SpaceX's plans include launching 12 1,000 satellites into orbit. And you can bet that other companies are looking to do the same thing as access to space increases and the cost comes down. With so many satellites up there, it's only a matter of time before our pristine views of the heavens start to suffer.
And is there a way around it, Chris? Can they be made to sort of, kind of like they do with the lighting on Hawaii Island, which you mentioned, is there a way to sort of make the satellites more invisible?
Well, unfortunately not, and it's not a very easy problem to solve. Clear dark skies should be preserved for many reasons, but it will take dialogue with space companies and careful planning to ensure that we keep it that way. With space rapidly opening up, this is a conversation that has to happen sooner rather than later.
A fascinating discussion, Christopher Phillips and Stargazer this week. Thank you so much.
You are welcome, Dave.
And I'm Dave Lawrence. We'll catch you next week. And you can find Stargazer at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for Stargazer comes from Haleakala Ranch, with a legacy of livestock, conservation, and land stewardship since 1888, working to create, maintain, and preserve open spaces for the Maui community. More at haleakalaranch.com.
Earlier in today's show, we asked you who brought coffee to the islands. Well, the answer lies in King Kamehameha II's delegation to England in 1824. On the return voyage, the delegation stopped in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil, and Oahu's Native Hawaiian and High Chief and Royal Governor Boki went ashore there and retrieved 30 coffee plants. Now, Boki brought these coffee plants back with him to Oahu Island in 1824. And although farmers now cultivate a different variety of coffee in the islands, Boki's vision of a vibrant coffee industry in Hawaii still flourishes. And no winners today. We stumped you on that one. That is today's quiz. If you have an idea for one, send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Last June, on a trip to France, we searched out a Paris address where Princess Kaʻiulani stayed in the 1800s. During some digging at the Hawaii State Archives, we came across letters that she wrote home of her time in the City of Lights and in the south of France. All that came together as we began tracing some of her steps in Europe. Here's a clip from the British art film that we introduced you to yesterday.
I am fairly worn out with all my travels, but what a wonderful time I've had. Such a wonderful time.
And we found the address of the apartment where the princess lived in the City of Light. 37 Marceau Avenue is not far from the Arc de Triomphe. It is now a three-star boutique hotel with just 35 rooms. The staff at Hotel Marceau Champs-Élysées was delighted to learn of the Hawaii connection to Hawaii royalty. Now, it was a bit of history that was also a surprise to Maile Kaku, a Hawaii transplant. She dances with the Halau Hula O Manoa, a halau that started in Paris more than 25 years ago. She was our link to the princess's past in Brighton, a seaside town in England where Kaʻiulani once lived. She consulted on an art film put together by students at the college in Brighton, England, which touched on the princess's time overseas. Here's Maile Kaku.
So we thought we would try and bring the spirit of the princess back to Brighton through a hula. So we set out to find a hula, in a way. Also, part of the project was to teach this hula to kids her age who were in a dance program in Brighton. And so it was sort of a long search, and Kilohana Silv, our kumuhula, really became very enthusiastic about it and helped us out and did a lot of research and found that her kumu, Auntie Ellen Castillo, had actually choreographed a dance about Kaʻiulani for Mary Monarch. And we tried to find the dance. It was not on internet and it was not on YouTube, and she finally found it in a VHS version in an old box in her attic, and then we had to convert it, and that's how our halau became involved in that. And then we sort of went back and choreographed the dance so that the young kids in Brighton could do it. Princess Kaʻiulani she lived 9 years, for 9 years of her life here in Europe. And the fact that she lived here in Paris, we don't know very much about what she did here in Paris. And we'd like to find out more in order to honor her presence here in Paris.
¶¶
Kaku was touched by a letter that the princess wrote home of a fatal fire that broke out at a charity Grand Bazaar event that she was to attend. More than 100 people died in that blaze. A new gown for Kaʻiulani was ready and laid out, and her father, Archibald Cleghorn, was planning to escort her there. But a migraine headache changed those plans and may have saved her life.
My dear aunt, many thanks for your kind letter. Annie's sudden death has been a very great shock to both of us. I can hardly realize that the dear girl has gone. I am sorry to say I am not feeling at all well. My nerves are all out of order, and I suffer continually from headaches. I dare say you have already heard of the awful catastrophe which took place here at the Bazaar de Charité. I have never heard of anything so fearful in my life. Nearly all of the 117 victims were women, and young ones too. There is a count next door who has lost his two daughters, girls of 18 and 19. What strikes one so is its being in one's own station of life, the smartest society of women of Paris. The death of the Duchess d'Allemont throws the Austrian, Belgian, and Bavarian courts into mourning, not counting the Arlians and the kings of Naples families. Just imagine all those people gone in less than half an hour, and the dreadful agony that they must have suffered. I have never seen any place so overcast as the gay city of Paris. You see, all the people selling were connected with the highest aristocracy of France. I hope that you are keeping well and that you are enjoying yourself in Washington. I am going on the 18th to Ravensdale, Tunbridge Wells, to stay with the Davies. I hope the change will do me some good.
And while Princess Kaʻiulani had planned to move to Paris from England, following those events, those plans changed. That chapter of her life in Paris closed. To see photos of the Paris Hotel, go to the conversation page at hawaiipublicradio.org. And that is it for today. Up tomorrow, we explore more of the impacts of the tit-for-tat tariffs. Tell us what's on your mind. Call our talkback line. Leave us your comments. That number, 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. We're on Facebook at The Conversation HPR and Twitter at HI Conversation. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.